go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott.
And I'm Ben. We are joined, as always, with our super producer, Noel Nuclear Brown.
Good one. I like Intercontinental.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's good. That's good. So, from those two clues...
How about we pass this one up? How about Noel Ballistic Brown?
Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
Noel, did you hear that? Do you like that one?
That might be the best one of the year so far. We're at the end of the year.
We got two thumbs up. Yeah. I'm glad that we got a good nickname finally in the beginning of the podcast.
You're right here at the end of the year as well.
Right here.
Oh, well, okay. Gives us something to shoot for next year.
Mm-hmm. See, intercontinental, ballistic, nuclear, shoot for.
All of these are really cool names. Peacekeeper.
Peacekeeper.
Mm-hmm.
That's a heck of a nickname. So this is completely unrelated, Scott and ladies and gentlemen, but I met a friend of a friend that I used to know in high school. Guess what name he goes by?
I can't even begin.
Snakebite.
Snakebite.
What 80s movie did this guy walk out of?
He goes by Snakebite.
He's a grown man.
And everybody calls him just that, not his real name.
I'm sure people still call him Justin.
Well, I see why he's going with Snakebite. No, I'm just kidding. That's fine. Justin's a fine name.
I'm kind of a little bit envious, you know?
Snakebite. That is a cool name to have. That's like almost as cool as T-Bone.
You gotta have your wits about you to pull off T-Bone. You know what I mean?
I guess so, yeah.
You better do something
pretty
cool.
These nicknames, man. I'm glad we started this a long, long time ago. Mm-hmm. Sorry, our listeners are accustomed to this kind of talk at the beginning of the podcast. But,
right.
Yeah, we gotta work on stepping up our game for next year. Maybe every one of them should be as good as like Ballistic or T-Bone or Snakebite or something like that.
Yes, and we can keep a list of the top ones later. Big dreams, but we're talking about nicknames here because this is one of my favorite things about military projects. I don't know if you've noticed it, Scott, but every time I read about something that the U.S. military has done, and our military stands head and shoulders above other militaries when it comes to this, we have this love of cool, can I say this on the family show, badass nicknames and designations for stuff. And then there's someone in the Pentagon. I've always wondered if it's just like one guy in the Pentagon whose job is to make cool acronyms.
It has to be. I mean, okay, so just as example, what we're talking about today. So go ahead and tell us what we're talking about.
Today we are talking about something called the Peacekeeper Rail Garrison.
Yes, yeah, so we're going to be talking about something that has to do with trains today. We don't always focus on cars and trucks and mm-hmm. other things. We focus on planes and boats and other things along the way as well. But today is a train-focused show. But this is different, and you may have picked this up already from the nicknames, but there's something a little bit special about this particular train or this series of trains that were supposed to happen.
Yeah, and let's go ahead and paint the picture here. So the U.S. has an extensive rail network, and at some point, many of the things that you purchase have been transported to your area via cargo ship and then rail.
I can give you some numbers if you'd like.
I'd love to hear some numbers.
All right, so these are pretty current. These are from the U.S. freight and railroad industry, the U.S. freight railroad industry. The number of freight railroads, so railroad systems in the United States, 575. Freight railroad miles, 138,524, and that's accurate as of 2016. So almost 140,000 miles of rail out there all across the United States. You can get numbers like that from places like the AAR, which is the Association of American Railroads, or mm-hmm. the freight railroad industry spec sheets that they put out sometimes, you know, PDFs or whatever online. But you can find current information and how that's grown over the years as well.
And the construction of the interstate system took some of the pressure off rail as a means of transit, but it's still huge in this country and in many other countries. And one thing that differentiates it perhaps from the paved roads and the asphalt is that not everybody can drive, quote-unquote drive, on the rail. So it's a little bit more of a closed system, right?
Mm-hmm.
This, in particular, is one of the reasons that the Peacekeeper Rail Garrison came about as an idea.
But we also have to mention this, though.
Yeah.
And this is just another element of the story.
Yeah.
At the time we're talking about, this is the end of the Cold War with the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
Between
yeah.
the United States and the Soviet Union.
Mid-80s.
Now this is something that's been going on since, what, 1947,
mm-hmm.
all the way through, I think it ended around 1991, and that date is critical in the story,
right,
the 1991 right. date. But when this came about was right in the middle of the Reagan administration.
Yeah.
And I think it's around 1986, wasn't it, when the idea was first kind of thrown out there?
Very close, very close. It's December 19, 1986.
And so the idea was, and here's the main thrust of this whole podcast, is that this would be a railroad-based system for deploying Peacekeeper intercontinental ballistic missiles. So you could deploy these all over the United States.
Yep.
And, you know, keep them in motion. So hopefully keep, you know, the enemy guessing. Where are they? Hopefully. We'll poke some holes in that plan
right,
a bit. But the idea was that they'd remain mobile and they could roam the country and either return or, you know, fire as necessary, you know, if given the command. And there's a lot to this whole story. I mean, it's interesting in the developments. It's interesting in the way that they thought it was going to work, really. And
yeah.
then, again, you know, what happened to the whole program, why it's not around anymore, because I guess that's a spoiler, Ben, you know, that it's not around now, of course. But there were some flaws in this program right from the beginning as well, and we'll discuss those too at some point in the podcast. But man, where do you want to start on this? Because there's so much to this. It's really interesting, fascinating.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's start at the beginning, or let's continue, because you are correct. December 19th, 1986, that's when the White House announces that then-President Reagan has given the green light for this. The reason the rail garrison would be called the Peacekeeper Rail Garrison is because of the type of missile it would be carrying, which was originally referred to as an MX, as we've mentioned. And what the idea, like what the thing was actually supposed to be or proposed to be, would be 50 train-based missile launchers.
Yeah, these would be on 25 separate trains,
mm-hmm.
two missiles per train, and we'll just, you know, can I describe the train?
Yeah, please.
All right, so the train would consist of two locomotives, two cars for housing security forces, which was kind of like a modified boxcar,
mm-hmm.
two launchers, each holding a single missile. And, oh, by the way, we'll talk about the car itself in just
right.
a moment, but those are incredible rail cars. Those are also modified boxcar that we'll talk about, a refrigerator car. A launch control car using a modified Westinghouse boxcar, and then a fuel car and a maintenance car that also used a modified boxcar. Now,
right.
that entailed hauling with them a crew of 42 people. 42 per train.
Well, that's counting security as well, right?
Yeah, but security is huge. So the 42 people, if you want to break that down,
mm-hmm.
There was a train commander,
mm-hmm.
there were four launch control officers, four railroad engineers, one medic, six maintenance personnel, and then 26 security police. And they all had to be able to live on this train for a time period of up to 1 month.
Right. So, the assumption being that they might have to be they might have to be in the wild, essentially.
Continuous motion.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if deployed, you know, they have to keep the enemy guessing where they are. And you got to remember, go back to 1986, and it's not like, you know, real-time instant satellite imagery of, you know, everything that's happening in the United States. And
mm-hmm.
and we weren't being monitored quite as closely as we are now, I guess, or we could be now. This was more of a system where, you know, the satellites would pass overhead every, 2 to 3 hours?
Right.
And then they would have to mark everything and note the distances between them to see if anything was in motion.
And that's similar. This idea of being a moving target is similar, but not as efficient, which we'll get into, as the idea behind nuclear submarines.
Yes. Yes.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. These are a little easier to spot, really. I mean,
well, yeah,
that's one problem, right?
That's,
I mean, they're
off the top.
Yeah, they're on the ground, and I mean, if let's be honest, the enemy knows what you're up to, really. I mean, they do.
Well, they know They know all the places that you could go. So clearly, this is a big investment. And there are several holes that we can poke in the concept here, both with just our own research and then with the help of some Trainhead forums.
The train enthusiasts, I guess. Yeah. Rail fans, that's what they call themselves, I think. Yeah. And rail fans have a lot to say about this program and maybe some of its shortcomings, but also some of the positives with it as well. But you mentioned price, Ben.
Yeah.
I have some specs on the missile itself.
Oh, boy.
So if you want to talk about the actual missile that this thing was carrying, it was carrying something called the LGM-118 Peacekeeper missile. And that's an intercontinental ballistic missile. And we were having a little discussion beforehand about the LGM designation because you'll see it marked two ways. And the way we have it figured, and I hope this is correct, we found it a couple places. It's typically referred to as LGM-118 Peacekeeper. The ones on the train, however, are referred to as MGM-118. And Ben, you were thinking that M stands for something in particular, right?
Yeah, for mobile.
Okay, so the ones that were placed on the train then became mobile, and that's really just changed the first letter designation for the missile itself.
Mm-hmm.
These are, again, intercontinental ballistic missiles, but they are nuclear-tipped intercontinental ballistic ICBMs. I'll just say it that way.
Yeah.
How about that? I'm getting tongue-tied on the long name, but ICBMs. And they have a couple of different detonation mechanisms. They could either be ground burst or they could be air burst. They had two different modes. They were 71 feet 6 inches in length, and the diameter was more than 7 feet. They're like 7.5 feet wide. These are huge missiles. So before I get into the numbers on this thing, I have to point out this photo that we've seen of this.
Yeah, you, Scott, you snagged a pretty fascinating photo. If you check out the Peacekeeper Rail Garrison online in an image search, the first thing you'll see is a fairly lonely-looking modified boxcar and a fairly normal, average-looking one.
Yeah, yeah. But the problem, click on that photo, though.
Right.
And that's where this becomes apparent because you think, that's not really, it's just a train car. It's a red train car. It's on a small piece of track that's out in the middle of a field.
What gives?
Yeah, really. So I clicked on that photo and enlarged it, and I realized about, made it much larger on the screen, about midway down that boxcar, there is somebody standing in front of it, but in the small photo, you can't even see that person. It's like a speck.
Right, so let's talk a little bit about the specs. So the length of the boxcars that would be holding the Peacekeepers would be 87 feet long, 10 feet wide, 15 feet, almost 16 feet high.
Yeah.
And they weighed, 550,000 pounds? These were beasts.
Yeah.
They were clearly not normal boxcars. And, Atlanta is a train town where we record this podcast, and we have some military contractors in the vicinity. So up Interstate 75, which runs through Atlanta, you'll find Lockheed plants.
Mm-hmm.
And every so often along the rails, not necessarily always from Lockheed, sometimes from some military bases down south and stuff, you can see the trains running by with, armored vehicles, military vehicles on there, components for aircraft. And what always gets me when we see all these trains crisscrossing, guys, I keep wondering what's inside them,
Yeah.
Because it could be 2 tons of Game Boys. You don't know.
Yeah.
It could be empty.
It's always fascinating when you have no idea what the cargo is in those things because there's so much of it. What is it? Is it food? Is it good? Is it goods of some kind? Is it furniture? Or is it it could be cars. Cars are usually evident.
Yeah.
But,
it's just like wheat.
It could be anything. But then you look at something like this and you see this cutaway where they reveal, the inside. It's kind of like an artist rendering of what this would look like as kind of like a ghosted image of what it would look like inside the boxcar. Pretty incredible. Now, that car, it's just enormous in size. It dwarfs other rail cars, it seems. All right, so we were talking about the specs of this missile, right? And there's a couple more things before we get to the cost per missile, which always blows me away. It's amazing.
Uh-huh.
So The operational range of this particular missile is 8,700 miles, and it's accurate within 393 feet, 7 inches.
Scary stuff.
That's really, really accurate for
that
distance.
Can you run 400 feet?
Oh, man. And
how quickly?
They were in service from 1986 until about 2005, and of course, this is the United States Air Force Initiative. That's who used it. All right, here we go. Cost per missile. In 1986, the cost per missile was approximately $70 million, and they were going to purchase 50 of these for this railway initiative.
Let's keep in mind that rolls in R&D cost as well, right?
Yeah, of course. So each missile then becomes a $70 million purchase for the military. That $70 million in 1986 when these were ordered would equate to something about ballpark $155 million each today.
Oh, my gosh.
So a lot of money when you're talking about 50 of those things. I didn't multiply that by 50 to get the full number. But there's more to it than that, of course, because then it would require a total of 50 of those giant Westinghouse modified rail cars that we were looking at just a moment ago.
Yeah.
Also, that train that I described and the crew of 42,
uh-huh.
50 of those. Oh, no, I'm sorry, 25 crews, 25 trains. So, for 50 missiles total.
Yeah.
unbelievable
enormous
program that they had planned. Yeah, really, really big. So this was going to be a huge contract for a lot of people, really.
And this also, due to secrecy concerns, security concerns during the Cold War, this required a little bit of subterfuge, shall we say, on the part of manufacturers and managers, because in some cases, and this was a big deal when it was exposed by 60 Minutes in the LA Times, in some cases managers of these projects had created false shell companies to get test equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And while that does seem disingenuous, and it certainly is, it was meant to be disingenuous, because otherwise there's somebody on the other side of the Atlantic or the other side of the Pacific. Look, Russia. There's someone in Russia.
Yeah.
And they're monitoring purchases.
Yeah, this is like the old shell game, right? I mean, which one is it under and who's doing what? And no one really knows exactly who's got the actual contract. It's kind of the same idea as when they have three or four identical cars for a diplomat of some kind, and you don't know which car that person's going to be in. And it's like that kind of game.
Yeah.
It's like they're all identical. It could be in any one of those. It's for safety. Safety all around. And it's just for also to, keep national secrets secret.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it makes perfect sense.
And here's a thing that may surprise some people. This was not the first project of its kind. And there were lessons learned from the past, and we'll get to them. But first, a word from our sponsor.
And we're back. And Ben, just a moment ago, you were teasing us a little bit with the idea that this might not be the first time the military had placed missiles on a train.
Absolutely. You are right, Scott. They were taking some lessons from the Minuteman Mobility Test train. This was a Cold War train, also built for Strategic Air Command testing before they launched Minuteman missiles on rail, or that was their plan at least. They had a couple of things that happened with this. One of the big ones was Operation Big Star. It was a series of U.S. military exercises using four trains over the Northwest and Midwest during the summer of 1960. So if you were in that part of the country during the 1960s, you may have had some exciting things rolling by you in secret. And
I like that idea.
Yeah.
I mean, like you said before, you just have no idea what's in those rail cars when they pass
by. Yeah, no idea. And so despite these earlier demonstrations of the idea, it didn't really take. The Peacekeeper got pretty far. After several years of development, the U.S. Air Force finally received a prototype.
Right. In 1990, that's when the prototype was delivered from the U.S. Air Force to Vandenberg Air Force Base in California.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, the car was sent to a transportation test center in Pueblo, Colorado. And then for further testing, to the Association of American Railroads, where they have like kind of a test track set up.
Yeah, and here's what they planned to do. They planned to roll this on the test track, see if there were any problems, first with just the nuts and bolts of it, right? How does a modified rail of this, or how does modified rail stock of this sort function? Is everything copacetic on that front? And let's just not, let's pretend there's not going to be a nuclear warhead in here. And then something, well, many people will say it was wonderful, happened. The Cold War ended in 1991.
Well, of course it was wonderful, but the problem was the timing with this. So here we are. We've got, two examples of this that were built. The plan was to build another 23. It's good that all of this ended. I mean, let's sure. put it that way. It really is. But the problem was the timing was just horrible on it. I mean, this is a war that had been going on since 1947, as we said. Here it is, 1991, and suddenly it abruptly ends. And, of course, I mean, clearly it wasn't expected to end back in 1986 when all this was kind of, gearing up, I suppose, when they were ordering, the contracts and all that. But glad it happened. So 1991, that's basically the end. That's when the Soviet Union falls. And there's no longer need for this. So what are you going to do with, you've got this one prototype test car. They had two, but I think one of them, I don't know if it exists. It just doesn't exist anymore. The other one was put on display in Dayton, Ohio, at the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio, starting in 1994. But they took those missiles. They had two missiles as well, right, that were formerly MGM missiles, as we mentioned before, and they moved them into some silos like any other standard ICBM would be.
Yeah, and once they put them there, the program, got scrapped, and that's fortunate for history, right?
Yeah.
But it's also fortunate for some practical reasons, and this goes into our, I guess, myth-busting, our skepticism regarding this project.
Yeah, and you know what? Let's talk about that in just a moment after we have one more word from our sponsor.
And we are back. Scott Benjamin, Scotty B, lay it on me. lay it on me and the rest of our listeners here. Why is this... I'm not going to say a terrible idea. Mm-hmm. Why is it not as smart as it might seem at first?
Well, okay, a lot of this comes from a train forum that you pointed me to, and it was cs.trains.com. And, this forum that's discussing, I guess, just this in particular, this peacekeeper garrison. And some of the thought processes that they go through are different than, somebody who's not really a rail fan would have. So they understand what it takes, to rebuild rail after it's damaged, and they understand the limitations of the train, traveling on rail, and they understand the whole system more than us. Like, what it would take to keep this thing on the road for a month with this type of payload,
right?
And they have a different thought process than a lot of us do. So it was interesting to read through those. One thing that I initially thought of before we get into some of their concerns, and we've kind of touched a couple of them already, but one thing that I was thinking of was that, if the enemy knows that you've got these on rail, then they simply watch rail. They don't have to watch the rest of the open country to find out where they are. Now, these 50 missiles, rather, on 25 trains were supposed to supplement an additional 50 missiles that were in silos all around the United States. So, there's potentially 100 ICBMs of this type, of this sort, all over the spread across the United States. So that's a lot of targets. And I guess, maybe the underground missile silos are a little bit easier to hide maybe than the trains.
Sure.
If the enemy knows what you're up to, if that's something you can monitor. But then again, we talked about the monitoring, and that was difficult then too because of the technology. It just wasn't what it is now. So it was a little bit more archaic in the way they had to do it with the satellite passovers,
the occasional spotting.
With the taking reconnaissance photos as they passed over, but that was only good every, 2 or 3 hours or whatever it was, as they passed overhead or how often it was. I can't remember the interval. But it was a different system, and it required a lot more effort to really track something than it does now. So that's one flaw right there.
Yeah.
The rail fans had a bunch of other stuff to say as well.
So here's one. What happens when it fires?
Yeah. Have you ever seen the test launch of these things? it does a lot of damage underneath when it fires, doesn't it?
I mean,
of course. And you know, this is a missile that's got three stages of solid rocket fuel on board. But you could imagine that the one that it requires to cheat gravity is a very strong stage. When it ignites. So what's that going to do to not only these prototype rail cars that they have built, but what's it going to do to the surrounding cars, the control cars, the quarters cars, I guess, the ones where the people sleep, the rail itself, that it's sitting on?
Sure, they thought about this too, but what about the fuel car?
So within a short distance, there is a fuel car, and that is a problem. You're right. So you pointed this out earlier, and I don't know if you have access to this right now where you can read what somebody said, but they said, well, that's a great plan and everything, but what about this? And they laundry list a bunch of items that they would need to take with them to repair the track after they fire.
Yeah. Yeah, they said it should be fine as long as you brought along the fire trucks, a crane, a flat car full of panels, track gang, and another set of cars with track machinery for what you did after the thing was set off while parked on the main line somewhere. And the original premise was to be tucked into a road freight or road switcher, consist of coal trains tucked between a set of buffer cars. No special train going into and out of Cheyenne, Warren Air Force Base. And then the question is, what happens to the fried of a crisp car the thing launched from, even if it's in a condition to move?
You know what I mean? It seems like you would just knock it over, recouple the train wherever you can, and get back to the base. But the problem was the track itself would be – I mean, this thing, it's a violent thing when this launches.
Yes.
Very violent and very hot. And it would melt it would cause a lot of issues with the track itself. So you would have to replace a segment of the train track. It becomes a huge logistical issue. That's something they didn't think of. And in fact, the railfan guys mentioned that maybe they should have consulted with somebody that has knowledge of that type of that type of system. And they didn't. They clearly didn't. There were a lot of problems that in addition to that, there were more problems as well, right?
Yeah, I want to point out though that they were thinking of these as single use throwaways, and mm-hmm. this was primarily a defensive measure rather than an aggressive measure.
Okay, so this is I understand. So it's fired in response to a first strike.
Yeah,
right?
It's more to hide them. Its first purpose is to hide these missiles, get all the eggs out of one basket.
Yeah, yeah. Smart move, right?
Smart move.
That
That's
is a smart move, and I guess you could deploy them via road, sure. But then there's the same issues, I guess. The same thing with are the road systems in fair enough condition for them to travel. There's always going to be an issue with when you're trying to deploy something like this. Like, how are you going to make sure that it gets to where it's supposed to go? You can't really ensure that. And I guess one thing that somebody would say right away, almost to every comment, you could respond this way. You've got bigger problems if you're launching nuclear missiles at another nation.
Right.
You got bigger problems than what's happening with that, 200 yards of track or whatever. You're not worried about freight necessarily at that point. Maybe later you will, but you probably won't.
When you're rebuilding the nation.
Well, yeah, when you're, rising from the ashes, that's the problem.
Because
that's the situation you're in when these were to be used. Like, if they're launched, that's kind of a doomsday scenario.
Yeah, and I know that sounds a little dramatic, but it's absolutely accurate. This is how you have to plan for these
things. That's not dramatic. Back then, it was always a real possibility, a real threat.
You're right. We cannot separate this from the context, the time in which it occurred. But we also would be remiss if we did not acknowledge one of the biggest problems with the plan, and again, this comes from the cs.trains.com forum. What if someone just blew up the tracks right outside of the base?
So contain them.
Yeah, before these 25 trains were able to roll.
So the first strike then would actually be a small attack, I guess, on the train, on the rail itself.
Yeah.
And then from that point, then it's kind of like you're sitting duck. And that could happen because, again, there was so much espionage going on during that time, back on both sides, of course. And probably still now, I'm sure there is. You know that somebody knows what's going on at all times. It's not, there's really not a lot of secrets. You know, you think you're keeping secrets, but there's not really a lot of secrets.
Not too many secrets.
And these are awful big things to keep secret. A train, as I've described, is tough to keep secret. It really is. I mean, I understand there's other things that you can, you know, keep contained and maybe, you know, keep a lid on, but the 25 trains like this, that's a tough thing. That's a tough thing to, you know, keep under your hat.
Even David Blaine would have a difficult time, right?
Well, yeah, and, you know, just pointing out the simplicity of a simple destroying of a section of railway, you know, to contain, you know, your best plan. That's a huge flaw right there. I mean, there's a lot to it, I guess. You know, there'd be a lot of planning involved, and you know, I don't know if that was something that was really possible, but because these were scattered all over the United States too. I mean, they were housed, or they were supposed to be housed at many different bases. It wasn't like they were all coming from one place.
Right, right. The issues that we see are present. They're not going to go away.
Yeah, and I'll tell you. I mean, just so that you get an idea, there were 10 bases that were in the running for they having these missile crews and on continuous alert. With these trains, and they were all over the place. They're in Washington, North Dakota, Texas, Missouri, Arkansas, Michigan. They were scattered all over the United States, and I guess if you didn't really know exactly where they were, you would have you can't blow up the railways that come out of every single base in the United States. It's a huge undertaking. So the chances are that, you know, they would be able to do that and kind of cripple the whole operation. That's unlikely.
Yeah, it's unlikely, but this is also a world of, you know, a world where a tiny likelihood of a massive catastrophe is worth planning for.
Yeah, sure. You know? And everything that we're talking about, because of this timing, this awful timing, is all what ifs. I mean, it never really came to fruition, you know. I mean, outside of the prototype and then one other, which I still don't know where that second car went.
Thank God. I think a lot of people who don't have earlier experience with it, I think a lot of people would be surprised by how intertwined national security or global militaries are with their rail systems. So if you look at some of the rail stations in North Korea or Russia, several function as bomb shelters as well.
And some were built specifically for troop transport.
Yes.
I mean, that was a common way to bring in and out goods and supplies to distant ports, mm-hmm. Because it was much easier than, traveling on roads that were almost non-existent or were, susceptible to, weather or nature of all kinds. Or of course, robbery, they could be set up in that way. Railway, I guess, same way, but it's just an efficient, quick way to get stuff in and out of a distant location, a remote location.
Would you ever be a train conductor?
No.
Why is that?
Never. I don't know. I don't think that it's something that I have any kind of interest in doing. Maybe it's because a lot of times when you hear about trains, it's because either derailing, they've hit a car at a crossing. It just seems like. And I know it's fairly rare, but when you think about what it takes to stop a train, when you think about the responsibility that's on the shoulders of those guys all the time, they're at the very front of as they cross the country, it's unbelievable. I mean, it'd be a lot of pressure on that job, I would think.
Oh, and you know what we must mention?
Wait a minute. You haven't answered yet. Would you ever be at the head of a train? What do you call it, steer a train? Yeah, I don't know if you steer a train.
Conduct.
You conduct a train? Is that what you do?
Yeah, that's a train conductor, man.
I guess. I mean, but you still say steer a train because you don't really steer it.
No. I would totally hang out in a train car.
Would you?
Yeah.
I would hang out in one, sure, but I don't think I'd want to be like the main guy, the guy that's in charge.
Oh, I think you have to earn that one. I don't think you just hop in and they say, okay, keep an eye. Here's the brake.
I imagine like a completely out of control, situation like, you've seen Polar Express, right?
Uh-huh.
Like when they're crossing that lake and the track's sinking into the lake. It's completely unrealistic, of course, but I imagine something like that going on, if I was at the controls.
Mm-hmm. So
You're just gonna leave that one.
I'm just gonna let that one go. Well, okay. Here's the thing. I'm fascinated by trains.
Yeah.
And I would love to maybe do a ride along. You know.
Yeah.
One week.
I love riding trains. It's fun. I mean, I'm not talking like hopping a boxcar type of situation. I mean, like, you know, buy a ticket and sit on there, you know, and take their dinner car. Yeah, the dinner car, wherever they just go straight out and straight back.
Yeah,
I've done that before. I think there's somewhere you can sleep overnight. That'd be kind of fun, maybe.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I don't know.
I would love to travel by train.
Would you like to be part of the crew though? Like, you know, someone who's working on a train.
I don't know. It depends on what I'd have to do.
You know, I don't think my grandmother lives right near a train track. It goes right past her house.
Oh, yeah?
And she mentioned something to me a few years ago, and she said that there are no more cabooses on trains. You don't see a caboose anymore.
No.
And
unless it's like a novelty.
Is that because there's less crew? Is that what's going on? Because that's where the crew would kind of hang out, right? That's their quarters. So does that mean that it takes fewer people now to run a train? I'd love to know why there are no more cabooses on trains, but she's noticed it years ago. And mentioned it to me, and now that I'm paying attention to it, I see that. I see that there are no cabooses.
Yeah, there haven't been cabooses. Unless the design changed, I haven't seen them. Apparently, they were on every freight train until the 1980s because of safety laws, but then those laws got relaxed.
Until the 1980s. But you know what? They hung on a lot longer than that because I can clearly remember seeing cars.
Well, 1980s was when they had all cabooses. All trains had to have cabooses.
Okay.
What it sounds like happened is that they relaxed the law a little bit. So now if you see a caboose on a train, it's either a tourist railroad, you know, like the one that runs in Stone Mountain or something.
Sure, because people expect it to be
right.
There.
Or it's a hazmat train.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
That would be one of the other ones.
Because they require extra crew.
You got to have someone to blame if something goes wrong.
Guys in the back. It's the guys in the back that are the problem.
It's the caboose crew.
Yeah, it's not me, the conductor, as you say.
I want to say this, Scott, before we get out of here.
Okay.
Before we get out of here, I do want to point out that this program, we mentioned earlier how it did not begin in a vacuum because there were earlier domestic programs, but the Soviets had one too. They had two programs that were very similar.
Where did they get that idea? Or did we get that idea from them? See, that's the thing.
I think we got it from – well, that's interesting because of the way the timing works out, because we had the earlier program it wasn't Scott and I back then, but, you know, like the U.S.
Yeah.
Had the program in the 1960s, that testing, and then the Soviet program had two branches, the S-24 and the S-25. These were mobile intercontinental ballistic missile launchers. The first one, the 24, ran on railroads, and the second one, the 25, ran on paved roads. And so...
Also, that was a like a truck-based system.
And so apparently... Yeah, apparently we said, hey, this is kind of a good idea. It was probably a lot less plagiarism and a lot more concern for some kind of gap in capability.
Sure. Yeah, that's well, I guess you could maybe just take it at face value and think that they were developed, separate from one another. You know, that someone – that you know how that works out, right? We've talked about that, about vehicles and all kinds of things, inventions that happen simultaneously – that are the same idea, but they have never heard of each other. You know, have never seen a design from somebody else. It just happened to happen right around the same time. You know, within a year or two of each other.
Right, because the infrastructure, in this case, the infrastructure already exists, so it is possible.
I would like to think that's the way that happened, but I feel that that's like a copying thing. You know, that they've got this, we better do that.
Sure, it is, and the days of the mobile ICBM are not over by any means. In 2011, research suggested that both China and Russia were redeveloping those mobile systems, but they were redeveloping stuff that had previously been scrapped.
Hmm.
You know,
likely smaller too, if I had to guess.
Miniaturization is one of the big moves.
I mean, I have no notes in front of me, but I wonder if they're still 71.5 feet long, and if, you know, they're 8 feet wide or whatever they were. I just wonder, you know, how that looks now. Compared to then.
Here's the thing, though. If the U.S. Air Force were to get involved with a similar program, a study by the RAND think tank said that new systems of this sort would very likely cost almost two times, perhaps even three times more than just using what we already have.
Wow.
This kind of development's expensive, so I would be surprised if at this point we saw those kind of systems coming back. This is sort of a snapshot, a brief glimpse at one of the projects considered during the Cold War, and there are so many other strange things they have done with vehicles. You know, I'd like to hear from our listeners on this one, man.
Yeah, I would too. I mean, this is okay. You said it's just one, so this is the Peacekeeper Rail Garrison. Mm-hmm. What were some of the more unusual programs that the military had? I'm going to bet you find a bunch of them right around that time in the Cold War era, because all the secrets that were kept and all the the interesting interesting ideas that they had about deployment. I read somewhere this is maybe the last thing that I have really, but one of their ideas was that they were going to somehow keep missiles underneath the Great Lakes. And here's the way they were described. They said just kind of rolling around underneath the Great Lakes without any other description than that. Now, I don't know how that would work. I don't know what they're talking about, but rolling around underneath the Great Lakes?
That's got to be hyperbole.
I think it is. And they said, Canada had a lot of objections to that, of course. You know, we're keeping our missiles underneath the lake that, you know, we share in between the border there.
Well, nobody wants a foreign country's military hardware on their border.
Yeah, nuclear tip missiles, just below the surface of the water. You don't want that, really.
Where are you guys putting them? Oh, they're just rolling around.
Don't worry, they're underwater, real close. Don't worry. there are ideas like that that are out there, and I wonder, how many other really strange programs there were that, have something to do with rail or air or, some type of road transport. I'd just be fascinated to see what's going on.
Yes, and as time passes, we learn more about this stuff in retrospect.
Yeah.
And it also makes me think of what's going on now.
Well, yeah, we talk about DARPA and we talk about, some of the crazy stuff, but that's only what they tell us, of course. There's nothing, we don't really get to know the juicy stuff until years after it's already happened and they say, we canceled that, but this is how cool it would have been.
I want to hop on one of those surveillance blimps if they're not. I think some may be unmanned, but
is this the one that? This is the one that they were talking about using for the Olympics. Is that the one they could take images of the whole city and you could zoom in?
Oh, for Rio de Janeiro.
Is that what you're talking about?
That's definitely one of them.
Okay,
but there are others that are apparently at very, very high altitudes.
Oh man. Okay, we've got a lot to talk about.
I've been trying to hop in that Goodyear blimp. You see the one rolling around the city?
Yeah.
For like 6 months now.
I've read something somewhere. I think you have to be invited to do that. I don't think you can.
Yeah.
I don't think they just allow you to walk-ins. No, you can't, walk up and say, I've got $5,000 I'd like to ride. I think you have to be specifically invited. Because, it's usually over an event, when they fly.
Yeah.
Unless they're transporting.
I would love to do it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, noted.
Just putting that out there.
It's out there in the ether now.
If
so
there's a blimp tycoon.
If there's someone with Goodyear. Yeah, Ben would love to have a ride. How about the MetLife blimp? Would you like to ride in that one, or just any blimp in particular, or does it have to be the Goodyear blimp?
It's got to be the Goodyear. No, I'm kidding. Any blimp. Are you kidding? Any port in a storm.
Well, that's kind of the iconic one, right?
Well, okay. Absolutely nothing to do with the Peacekeeper Rail Garrison, but Scott, I will confess to you, my favorite airship scene is, of course, from Indiana Jones, where they're attempting to escape Germany, and they're turning it around.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of want to do the Indiana Jones thing, mm-hmm. which I know they won't let me do because I would destroy the ship.
You should ask.
Yeah, who knows? They probably get that all the time.
They might have an old one laying around, that they're just like, why don't you take him out in old number 6 over there?
I doubt that there is a – throwaway blimp. But you know what? Dare to dream.
Yeah. It could be like the clunker on the lot,
Yeah, right. Well, while we go off to see if we can hitch a ride on a blimp or destroy one to reenact an Indiana Jones film, you can check out some of our earlier podcasts, all of which are available at carstuffshow.com. We've done some stuff on locomotives in the past. We've done a little bit on rail racing as well. So you can check those out for free. You can also find Scott and I on Facebook and Twitter, where we are CarStuffHSW. And If you have a suggestion for something we should cover in an upcoming show, something you think your fellow listeners would like to know, or if you have some personal experience with the world of rail.
Or can you arrange that blimp ride?
Or you can arrange a blimp ride. We'd love to hear from you. You can write to us directly. We are
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.